How can Sprint and T-Mobile keep up with the competition? How about a merger?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Good morning from APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Sprint and T-Mobile, the third and fourth largest cell phone companies in the U.S., are reportedly talking about a merger. It's not confirmed yet, but T-Mobile and Sprint stock jumped 4% yesterday on the rumors. Let's get the details now from Marketplace's Gregory Warner. He's with us live. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what do we know?
Well, we've heard these rumors for a while about this merger, but what's changed now is that in tough times, Sprint has managed to hang on to its customers and T-Mobile has been losing them. So in the past, these talks of a merger didn't progress because the companies couldn't agree on who was buying whom. Now it is more clear that Sprint is buying if T-Mobile can agree on the price. And of course, a combined company would have almost as many subscribers as the two big guys, Verizon and AT&T. And then with that bigger base, they'd have more weight to pull in, say, going to, say, Apple and asking to put the iPhone on their network.
All comes back to the iPhone. Greg, what does this mean for customers?
Well, if this merger happened, and it is totally preliminary, but it probably would be bad for customers on price, at least, because right now Sprint and T-Mobile try to undercut each other with cheaper plans because they're competing for your business. And if they're the same company, that incentive goes away. Also, if they become one company, they're juggling different technology. So your phone might be CDMA, my phone might be GSM. That's a lot of letters, a lot of frustration.
Sure is. Marketplace's Gregory Warner, thanks.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, Idaho has become the latest state to slash union rights for public sector workers. The state legislature approved a bill on the matter yesterday. In Washington, D.C., today, a congressional committee will look at how compensation for federal workers compares with the private sector. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
According to the latest government statistics, the nation's 2 million federal workers are paid, on average, 23% less than similar private sector employees. But James Shirk, a labor scholar at the Heritage Foundation, will tell the committee today the government is missing the bigger picture.
When you include the value of their benefits, the typical federal worker is earning between 30 and 40% more than a similar private sector worker.
Shirk thinks the government should contract out more jobs to private companies where wages and benefits are more competitive. But Max Steyer with the Partnership for Public Service says been there, done that.
Contracting has actually been the largest growth industry of government for quite some time. And there's a real argument about whether we're getting better value.
The head of federal personnel will tell the committee that comparisons between government and private workers can be misleading. Government cooks, for example, may earn more than their colleagues in restaurants, but many government cooks work in prisons, where the working conditions are more hazardous. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
And let's do the numbers. Stocks are mixed across the globe. Right now, Hong Kong is up about 0.4%. London is down about 0.3%. New census data show growth in California is slowing because of high unemployment and the cost of housing. The black population here in the Golden State declined for the first time on record, and now more than half of Californians under the age of 18 are Latino. On Wall Street yesterday, the Dow jumped 124 points to close at 12,214.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as online savings account and money market account. Learn more at allybank.com. By Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at microsoft.com/cloud. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
Have you heard of the term green chemistry? It's been around for a couple decades, and it's all about making the stuff we use every day less toxic and less wasteful. Well, now, as Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, one of green chemistry's founders is out to prove you can make money with it, too.
John Warner was a top industrial chemist when his 2-year-old son died from a rare birth defect.
Lying awake at night the evening of my son's funeral, staring at the ceiling, asking myself, what if something I touched caused my son's disease? What if something that I got an award for ultimately caused my son's death?
Warner and his friend Paul Anastas developed green chemistry in the 90s. Their idea was that industrial processes don't have to be bad for humans and the environment. They could be benign by design, so to speak. Warner preached that gospel for years as a chemistry professor. Now he's trying to prove green chemistry can work in the real world.
And so in this lab over here, we have people working on large object ceramics.
Ceramics as in bathroom fixtures. Warner now heads a small startup company north of Boston called the Warner Babcock Institute. It helps its clients, from drug companies to cosmetic firms, by coming up with non-toxic, more energy-efficient, and less wasteful ways to make their products. And those clients want to save money by doing it. Warner says that's possible. After all, toxicity carries a pretty high price tag.
Look at the amount of money we spend in hazardous waste. Look at the amount of money in storage. Look at the money in transport. If you have a hazardous material, it just costs so much money.
Warner doesn't divulge his client list or revenues, but says the company has worked with 18 clients so far and is cash positive. Among their successes, reducing the amount of chemical waste from making a Parkinson's disease drug and figuring out a way to use less energy in making solar panels. Oh, and there's the hair dye that's less toxic. A now brown-haired Warner says he's been the lab guinea pig on that one.
This is a chemistry experiment. This isn't a product yet, but, you know, obviously, it's on my head.
In Wilmington, Massachusetts, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
And finally, have I got a deal for you. It's a 1902 mansion set on 13 acres in beautiful Sands Point, Long Island. And unless you buy it, it's going to be torn down at the end of the month. It's available for the low, low price of $30 million. Now, one thing, the maintenance costs are around $4,500 a day. But get this, the house was the inspiration for Daisy Buchanan's house in The Great Gatsby. That's the one with the green light at the end of the dock. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson on Twitter at Jeremy Hobson, and this is the Marketplace Morning Report. And this is APM, American Public Media.
Clinical trials are some of the most important and expensive things that drug companies do. So they're outsourcing.
The number one reason why companies come to Russia is that they can enroll patients in Russia anywhere from 3 to 20 times faster than in either North America or Western Europe.
I'm Kai Rizdal. The doctor is in Moscow. That's next time on Marketplace from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.